presentation. Very enjoyable conference. I think the topic that I'm going to talk about may be less familiar to the majority of you than some of the other topics, so I've decided to follow the suggestion of spending a lot of time just filling in the background. So I think basically the first half hour of the talk, for those who are already expert or who know well the subject of isomonodromic deformations, there will be nothing new. I'm just reviewing the background of the subject. Oh, thanks very much. That's terrific. They have one of those. Yeah. And only the last perhaps 15 minutes will be new results. In fact, I think the last transparency is the only one that will contain new results. So for those who are expert in the subject, my apologies. Also, I should say that I guess this topic is a little bit in a different spirit from most of the others, because it deals with a broad, very broad class of problems which are of considerable interest, but it's mainly dealing with formal aspects of it. I'm not going to be studying or talking about any specific properties of solutions or solution manifolds, but I'm very happy to be able to present this anyway, because in a sense it's the completion of something which I've thought about for many, many years and had done some earlier work on. I'll mention that. And now I would say finally, at least as far as the understanding of the Hamiltonian structure of, well, rational isomonodromic deformations, and in fact more generally deformations on other Riemann surfaces, I think the Hamiltonian side is now complete. So this is sort of the end of the phase. But all of the new results, as I say, will just be in the last transparency. So bear with me a little bit if you already know the topic. So I should motivate it, I guess. I'll define exactly what class of problems one is looking at. It's a problem in a sense, it's ODEs. You could say it's PDEs, but it's a Frobenius completely integrable system, so you could look at it as though it's just a lot of ODEs that are living harmoniously together, but it implies PDEs since all the cross derivatives agree. That's harmonious analysis. That's right. Yeah. So, and the motivation, my own motivation, I came to it mainly from studies in integrable systems. I realized, I mean, those people who study integrable systems, the recent last 30 years' development has largely been based on the basic notion that one can always, in a sense, program integrable systems into a linear system which is deforming in such that is a linear operator which is deforming under the dynamics in such a way that its spectrum is invariant, so there are isospectral deformations, and that's where the inverse spectral theory comes in. A huge technology has been developed over the last 30 years on the inverse spectral technique, and well, the key word there, which we've heard from many speakers, is the Riemann-Hilbert method. Well, the Riemann-Hilbert method is also, in a sense, the key method of analysis for inverse monodromic problems. So I'll define that in a moment. But it's a sort of first cousin to isospectral deformations. If you look at deformations of differential operators with singularities that preserve the monodromy or the generalized monodromy data, it's a little bit analogous to isospectral deformations. But in fact, it's quite different. However, qualitatively quite different. However, they do come up often in the same context. And to some extent, the relation between the notion of isospectral and isomonodromic deformations is something that is quite intriguing. If I could just give a couple of sort of just general descriptive words before we get into the actual technical details. The isomonodromic deformations also have Hamiltonian structures, the same as integrable isospectral deformations. The key difference is that they're non-autonomous. And it's rather intriguing to see the interplay between all of the all that is known about autonomous Hamiltonian systems which generate isospectral deformations of linear operators and the associated non-autonomous systems that generate deformations of differential operators that preserve their monodromy. The applications, as many of you know, come partly from theory of integrable systems, where one really studies that for its own sake, the quantum integrable systems, where one encounters isomonogamy deformation equations as characterizing correlation functions in many quantum integrable systems, and in the theory of random matrices. So they crop up very frequently, and so it's worthwhile making a very careful analysis of that general domain. It's not a new domain. It's something that has been studied for over 100 years. I'll be mentioning references that go back 100 years, but it's amazing that there were, until recently, still unsolved or unresolved aspects of the theory that are worthwhile investigating. Okay, so here comes a very quick review. I'm afraid that time will not allow for too many concrete examples, but I will stop along the way with particular cases. So here's the general situation. Everyone see that all right? One is interested. Sorry? Yes. You want it bigger or smaller?
Bigger.
Okay. Of course, it'll be out of focus.
Bigger is better.
Okay.
Higher, faster, louder.
Okay. Let's get it on the screen.
And are you going to use both of them?
There's only one.
This
doesn't work? This is already tied up to an overhead, to a computer, I think.
No.
Isn't it?
No.
Oh, I'd be happy to use it if it's available.
Slightly.
Oh, all right.
Slightly brighter.
Okay. Oh, I can use that, too. Okay. Okay.
The things you want to see clearly, you put on the bright one, and the things you want to sort of slip over, rapidly, you put on the other one.
Okay. All right. So here's the context of the problem. One looks, for most of this talk, I'll just be talking about operators defined on the complex plane or the Riemann sphere, but much of this generalizes to more general Riemann surfaces. So one has what amounts to a rational covariant derivative operator. You don't have to think of it as that. You can just think of it as some rational matrix with poles, with pole support at n points. That remains invariant, but the location of the poles will be moving. And these terms are just the principal parts of the poles, the degree of the poles. It seems a bit funny to put the extra one. There's a reason for this. The degree of the poles is given by a sequence of integers, dr plus 1. Dr is known in the trade as the Poincaré index, and it determines the degree of irregularity of the singularity. So one has regular singular points when dr is 0, and irregular singular points when dr is larger than 0. And similarly, at infinity, one has a polynomial piece. Excuse me? J? Yes. No. I guess that's right. The first one should be from 0. Okay, so what we're interested in, we have to put some generic conditions, and basically the only thing that will be assumed is that the leading term of the principal part at each pole has a non-degenerate spectrum. Otherwise, this one can still do much of the analysis, but it doesn't go so smoothly. One has to look more carefully at such lower dimensional strata when the spectra are degenerate. So we'll assume that the eigenvalues of the leading term in all of these principal parts are distinct. And one looks at some fundamental system, so an invertible matrix X with values in. I'll always be taking traceless matrices here. A, these are traceless M by N matrices, so they're elements of the, if you like, the Lie algebra SLM. And the corresponding fundamental system can be thought of as an element of the group SLM. There's not very much lost by throwing the traces out because they behave themselves separately, and one can always extract the traces. So this is not really a restriction of fundamental importance. Okay, so one will look at fundamental systems, and associated to that, certain data. And the usual data are basically the behavior near the singularities and the behavior under analytic continuation if we look for movement around the poles. So the data that I'm listing here, as the generalized monodromy data, it's been more or less called that since 1920s, since Birkhoff, consists in particular of the this is a bit high for reaching with this, but anyway, consists of the monodromy representation, which just is obtained by removing all of the poles from the Riemann sphere, and then looking, if you go around some loop, you can take a base loop and go around that loop, analytically continue the fundamental system, it will at most change by multiplication on the right, of course, by matrix independent of X, and that's the monodromy matrix, and that gives you a representation, the monodromy representation, from the fundamental group of the punctured sphere into SLN, and that we denote M, is generated by the loops that go around your poles, so they're M generators. I think I've mixed up N and M royally here, so let me fix that up. This should be M. The number of poles is little M, and is little N, and the rank of the matrices is little M. Besides that, as you probably all know, when you have an irregular singular point, one also has the Stokes matrices. So one has sectorial asymptotics, which are only formal, but they can be related to genuine solutions asymptotically within sectors, within wedge sectors. I won't give the full theory of this, but I guess most of you are familiar with it. And the relation between the solutions with a particular formal normalization into adjacent Stokes sectors is what defines the Stokes matrices. So that's part of the generalized monodromy matrix and monodromy data. And finally, one has to have some reference point, which is conventionally taken at infinity, and connection matrices, which tell you what happens when you continue along some lines to the various singularities. So that's the full set, the monodromy representation, together with the Stokes and connection matrices, is a full set of generalized monodromy data. And what we will be looking at will be deformations of the covariant derivative operator, which don't change that data. Yes. It tells you how you have to choose some lines. This is conventional, which in order to basically you're comparing bases in which you have a standard diagonalization at different points. So you have to relate it all to one point, which is usually chosen as infinity. So added to that, one usually looks at this formal asymptotics. What this means is, of course, when we write y e to the t, t is supposed to contain all of the singular part, but this is not supposed to be understood. There's no asymptotic development for an irregular singular point. If the Poincaré index is greater than zero, then you only have sectorial asymptotics, but still there's data that can be extracted from leading term principal value data at the singularity contained in the... one can always, under the assumptions given, find a formal solution which looks for practical purposes like an analytic development plus the exponential of a polynomial of exactly the degree of the Poincaré index of the pole. So this exponential term, in fact, can always be chosen to be diagonal. So I've actually put everything very explicitly so we can see where the deformation parameters appear. So this, at each point, in the neighborhood of each point, there is such a formal solution which can be compared with genuine asymptotic developments of an analytic solution within the Stokes sectors. But this is the normalization in which T is a diagonal matrix. And Y has some normalization constant and looks, at least its leading term behavior, is as though it were analytic at that point. And all of the singular part is contained in the exponential. The exponential also has a... Sorry? Nothing whatsoever, I'm sorry. There are just so many letters in the alphabet. Yeah, these are the connection. I should call this maybe C. Let me give it a different name so we don't confuse it. But thanks. let's call it C. And I'll probably find something else that's called C as well. The connection matrices. Yeah. Okay, so basically the structure near each pole is, well, exactly what you'd expect. If the matrix A were the logarithmic derivative only of this singular part, it would exactly have this form, but of course these are diagonal matrices. The logarithmic part is what contributes the Fuchsian, the regular or Fuchsian behavior. If you only have that, then you do have an asymptotic development within a punctured neighborhood. So one has such a development, and I just want you to remember, because these will keep reappearing, that the relevant parameters will be these coefficients. Now these EAs are just the elementary diagonal matrices. I've just put everything explicitly so that every component is displayed. And I've just summed over the diagonal matrices. So these are the diagonal components. And so the three indices, one tells us where we are in the matrix along the diagonal, the other tells us which pole we're at, and the third tells us what the degree of that particular term is. And these things, as we'll see in a moment, will play the role of the deformation parameters. So the basic question in this topic is, how does, if one allow the location of the poles and the formal exponential factors to vary, how, or is it possible at all to, is it possible to correspondingly vary the matrices that appear in the principal part decompositions in such a way that the generalized monodromy data remains invariant? That's the basic problem. And earlier versions of this problem in the Fuchsian case were completely answered 100 years ago. I promised you an old reference, Schlesinger. And more modern version, which covered this general rational case, was treated by Jimbo, Miwa, and Ueno in 1981. And I'm spending the first part of the talk largely describing the work of Jimbo, Miwa, and Ueno with some extra extensions. So the basic idea is the following. In summary, the necessary and sufficient condition for preserving the monodromy of such an operator under deformations in which these parameters change is that all of the residue matrices, all of the numerators that appear in the principal parts, satisfy certain compatible overdetermined first order partial differential equations with respect to these deformation parameters. And these can be formalized this way. So one has already a sort of covariant derivative equation. What we do is essentially extend this to a covariant derivative equation on the larger space, which consists of the original punctured sphere, extended by the space of all deformation parameters. And in each direction, separately, there will be some matrix, so we'll have what amounts to a connection on this multidimensional space, combining the original space with the parameter space. And the structure of these deformation matrices is, of course, closely linked. I won't go into details. It's also closely linked to Riemann-Hilbert problems, and those who are familiar with Riemann-Hilbert problems will recognize the structure. But the rule is, if you look, you can express these infinitesimal deformation matrices in terms of the data that we've already seen. Namely, you take the partial derivatives of the exponent part in the direction of the deformation you're looking at, you conjugate by the analytic part, and you project to the principal part of that at the particular singularity. So these are the deformations that correspond to TARJ. And similarly, if you move the poles, you take the partial of that. That only really contributes to the logarithmic piece, and that gives you the deformation equations in the direction of the deformation of the poles. And so one can all express this in a slightly more compact way by introducing some differentials on this extended space, obvious differentials. So D is a differential only on the parameter space. So it's a scalar differential. This is a matrix-valued one form, which has A of x as its dx component, and the rest along the parameter directions is given by these various matrices. So these should be thought of as the various connection components along the different directions. And essentially, the compatibility, if you think of this as a covariant derivative equation, we're describing parallel transport independent of path. So the compatibility of such an overdetermined system is a zero curvature equation. So a nice way to summarize the compatibility conditions is just to say, well, take this full, think of this as a connection form, and take its covariant differential, which is essentially all the cross derivatives at once, and that defines a curvature. It's a two form, but basically the components of that two form are all partial derivatives of the matrices that have appeared in A, and that must vanish. So this is the totality of the differential equations which are necessary in sufficient conditions for the preservation of the monodromy, generalized monodromy of the operator under these deformations. Now, one might worry, a priori, this is itself an overdetermined system of partial differential equations. One might worry as to whether there are any second-order integrability, Frobenius integrability conditions to be satisfied, but part of the theory tells us that there are not. That is, that this, although it's an overdetermined system, this is a Frobenius integrable overdetermined system. Yeah, the bracket is a simultaneous exterior product and matrix bracket. Just typical notation for covariant derivatives. Okay, now there's one other piece of technology that I have to introduce, which is part of the story, and that's the so-called tau function, which is always present whenever you have a solution to an isomonodromic deformation system. I will define it exactly the way that Jimbo, Niwa, and Ueno defined it some 24 years ago. So we define another differential form, differential form by its coefficients. So a differential form on the parameter space in which the coefficients H here and here are labeled the same way as previously, but they're defined by this formula. The formula seems to come out of nowhere, but it turns out to be a very important definition. One takes the logarithmic derivative on the left of the holomorphic part with respect to x, multiplies it by the parameter derivative of the exponential part, takes the trace of the product and evaluates the residue at the point alpha r. So that defines some sort of a function on the space of parameters given any solution to the isomonodromic differential, to the zero curvature equations. And similarly for HR, we differentiate with respect to the local locus of the poles, and it can be shown quite directly that it follows that if you have a solution to the zero curvature equations, then this differential form is a closed form. We'll see it from another viewpoint, a Hamiltonian viewpoint, in a moment, but for the moment this is just a statement which is not very difficult to prove. And so at least locally, that means that there's some, that it's the differential of some function, and for reasons that, again, I won't try to explain, that is usually taken as a logarithm of a function, that is called the tau function. A priori, this only tells us that the tau function exists locally, and at most it can only be defined up to a normalization factor, because it's the only differential, logarithmic differential, is given. But as the theory develops, which I won't discuss, it can actually be shown under the assumptions that I've given, plus a few other very generic assumptions, that this, it's not exactly a function, but it can be extended beyond a local definition. It really should be thought of as a section of a line bundle. And it is something which is, aside from the points where the poles collide, which must be excluded, on this extended parameter space, it is globally holomorphic. The interesting points are when it vanishes, and this was proved many years ago also by Niwa and some other work by Malgrange, establishing the holomorphicity of this tau function. That is a version of what people refer to in the business as the Panlevé property. Now I'd like to turn to some specific examples. Yeah, okay. Oh, sure. Yeah, actually, you prefer if I leave them on both, don't you? All right. Yeah, I should have done that. Okay, let's look at the simplest and oldest case, namely the Schlesinger equations, which are the Fuchsian case. So as long as the eigenvalues, if we only have first-order poles in A, as long as the eigenvalues don't differ by integers, this is so-called non-resonant situation, and this is this only has regular singular points, this is the most general first-order system of Fuchsian differential equations. In that case, the quantity that I refer to as omega can easily be shown to just be the negative of the principal part at that point of the original matrix AX, and the zero curvature equations that I wrote down are these. They're very familiar. These are called the Schlesinger equations, been studied for 100 years. I've only put in, should be for S different from R. I've only put in the off-diagonal terms because the diagonal terms are equivalent to stating that the sum of the residues remain constant. And it's quite easy to verify for this case that what we call the logarithmic derivative of the tau function can be locally expressed in terms of the matrix A, namely it's the residue at x equal to alpha of the quadratic trace invariant. Note that although it's expressed here as a functional of the matrix A of X, if you think of the phase spaces consisting of all such matrices, it really is only meaningful on an integral manifold. So this is a composition, really, of this simple expression evaluated on some integral manifold, solution manifold of the equations. A particular case which is much studied, the simplest non-trivial case, actually, is when the size of the matrices is 2, there are only 3 poles. By conformal transformations, we can always normalize, there's really secretly a pole at infinity, which is why I call this A infinity. We can always put 2 of the finite poles at some fixed point, 0 and 1, without moving infinity, and then the only moving pole is T. There's one moving pole, and that's what we call alpha 3 is T. So I'm going to just normalize it using conformal transformations this way. And it turns out, after a little bit of work, if you call the eigenvalues of the 3 finite residue matrices plus minus theta r, and the one at infinity, theta infinity, these are 4 independent constants. And the equation basically reduces to the well-known Panlevé sixth transcendent, in which the 4 constants alpha, beta, gamma, delta have a simple relation to the eigenvalues theta 1 through theta infinity. Excuse me? I haven't defined u. U is part of the parameterization of A, and well, I can. There are a lot of conserved quantities. One sets all of the constants, all of the conserved quantities equal to constants. I mean, I didn't say it, but these are conserved quantities. So those are just constants. Thereby, you reduce the dimension of the space from 9 effectively to 3, and there's one ignorable variable, so it's really 2, and you have a first-order equation in 2 variables. I've already reduced it to the Newtonian form, and that's the Panlevé 6. So Panlevé 6, basically, aside from some rather trivial lifting, Panlevé 6 completely contains the non-trivial information in the Schlesinger equation with 3 finite poles, plus 1 at infinity, and 2x2 matrices. It's essentially the same thing in a reduced form. So that's very much studied and has lots of applications. Now let's just look for a moment. Is this sufficiently important to keep? Maybe not. I'll put it here. Now let's just look again at something rather old. This is a Hamiltonian system, and I'd like to just look in some detail at why the Schlesinger equations or Hamiltonian system. It's actually very simple and rather elegant. So you have a space of n tuples of SL, of traceless matrices, m by m matrices, and you can think of these matrices as living in the, it's convenient to think of the dual, because there's an actual Poisson structure on the space of traceless matrices, if you think of the Lie Poisson structure. So here I've just written it down. It's a direct sum of the Lie Poisson structures on n copies of SLM, and it's basically the thing dual to the Lie bracket. Lie already knew this Poisson structure. Here we're just multiplying m independent copies of the same structure. So what you do is if you have a pair of functions, they may as well be linear functions, but it doesn't really matter. You take a pair of functions, then if you think of this as a sort of matrix gradient, the derivative with respect to a matrix itself is a matrix. So we're back in the algebra rather than in the dual once we take the gradients. And we can commute these two matrices and pair it with the original point and evaluate the trace, and that is the dual object to the Lie bracket. And that's the Lie Poisson structure. So those equations are Hamiltonian equations with respect to this Lie Poisson structure on the direct sum of n copies of SLM in the following sense. Here are the Hamiltonians. Think of these as functions on the phase space consisting of n tuples of matrices and a very simple formula. You take the residue at the point alpha r, the trace of the square, and it's very easy to show that these Hamiltonians Poisson commute. In this particular case, the commutativity, we'll see in a slightly more general case, but the commutativity is exactly equivalent. If you remember, there was a little omega, one form which was defined, which was interpreted as the logarithmic differential of the tau function. The existence of that one form, of course, I mean, the fact that it's closed, had to be verified. This actually is the easiest way to verify it. The Poisson commutativity of these Hamiltonians is equivalent to the closedness of that one form. Now, in what sense? Okay, it's very easy to compute the Hamiltonian vector fields, and we can make them just act on A of x. We can program all of the data just into A of x. So a Hamiltonian vector field acting on A is obtained by taking the Poisson bracket with all the matrix elements of A. Yes? Yes. Well, the Jacobi identity is just satisfied by the definition, the way it's defined. But, that's... if, a fortiori, one could prove the closedness of the form omega as a consequence of the Poisson commutativity of these Hamiltonians. But that's a non-trivial statement. That needs to be computed. It's not difficult to prove. It's just automatic from the definition, because it is a Poisson bracket. So there's nothing to verify there. Well, it's a Poisson bracket. The symplectic leaves are the coadjoint orbits. So it's a degenerate. You have Casimirs as well. It's a Poisson manifold, but all the Hamiltonian flow... Well, that's very pertinent, and I'm going to be discussing that later on. All Hamiltonian flows, of course, live on symplectic leaves, so you could restrict to a symplectic leaf. But as you'll see in a moment, the isomonodromic deformations don't care about that. So let's see what happens. What really happens is the following. I said these are non-autonomous systems. The reason why they're non-autonomous is because to interpret them as Hamiltonian systems, we have to take that's supposed to be alpha, we have to take the location of the poles, which are already part of the definition of the matrix A of X, and treat them as the time parameters. So you have to distinguish now between explicit and Hamiltonian differentiation. So that means that when looking at a matrix A of X, the Hamiltonians themselves will now depend on these multiple times, which are really the location of the poles. And moreover, A of X explicitly depends on multiple times. But that's not what we're interested in. We're interested in the flows of the residue matrices under the Hamiltonian equations. But you can't escape moving the poles. That's part of the deformation. But when you move the poles, in some sense, although at the level of the level of SLn to the power n, that's just auxiliary data. It's just you're just tossing in a lot of extra things. But what you really should think of, because in the general case this is not so trivial, is that what one has is a single copy of our phase space. Times whatever, let's say, m-dimensional parameter space the poles represent. One should think of an extended manifold in which this is part of the data, and these are moving as well. But of course, from that viewpoint, these are Casimirs. They're all trivial invariants. No Hamiltonian flow would move them, but they are moving. So that means, in this sense, even at the level of Poisson manifolds, what we have is, well, within a given SLM or SLM to the power n, we have a symplectic leaf, and we can look at the symplectic leaves for different alphas as isomorphic to each other. But it's better to think of it as the picture that I'll be drawing later on, as a Hamiltonian vector field that is tangential to a symplectic leaf, plus something rather trivial, which is forcing us to move off the symplectic leaf, and that will come up later on, but in this case it's rather obvious. When we look at how the matrix A changes, there will be a piece which is the Hamiltonian vector field, which by the structure will be a commutator. So there will be a commutator piece, which is this. And there will be another piece, which is the explicit derivative with respect to the location of the poles. But the remarkable fact, if you just look at it explicitly, is that if you take A and differentiate it only with respect to alpha R, it gives a term like this, which, right? And that's exactly the same thing as what you would have had if you differentiated this with respect to x. That's a non-trivial statement. If that weren't true, this wouldn't be an isomonodromic deformation. Because by substituting for the first term a commutator, and for the second term the explicit derivative, a derivative of the deformation matrix, we get a zero curvature equation. So if this is that, yeah. In this sense, this is terrible. That should have been alpha. So the derivative of A has a Hamiltonian part, which is just given by the Poisson bracket, and this rather trivial part. But it's a coincidence that this trivial part just has the right form to be interpreted as the x derivative of the Hamiltonian deformation. And that's why the two combined together gives not an isospectral deformation, which it would be if this were absent, but a zero curvature condition, which is an isomonodromic one. Now here it's completely, it's right in front of our eyes, there's no doubt about it. But in the general case, which I hope to get to, it's not so trivial how these two combine. Let's go to a slightly more complicated case, which actually I studied some years ago, where one adds to all of these first-order poles in the Fuchsian system, we add a single second-order pole at infinity. Now, this is a constant diagonal matrix. That's a second-order pole at infinity because you have to think of the local coordinates. You really should look at it. This is a connection form, so you multiply by dx, and that gives you a second-order pole at infinity. So that's got Poincaré index 1. So that's a non-Fuchsian singularity, the moment you put in a constant term like that. The same theory applies. It turns out again to be Hamiltonian, and you have additional deformations now with respect to these parameters. So you have two sets of parameters, the location of the poles and the asymptotic spectrum of this operator, which is this matrix, which is just given by the diagonal values of T0. You can move those as well. They actually are amongst the exponential parameters that I described in the general case. They are the exponential parameters in that general case. And again, one has the exact same structure. One has a deformation differential matrix with, now it's got components along the alphas and the t's. The alpha part hasn't changed. It's still the same as it was before. The part along the T becomes a little bit more complicated. Its dependence on X is completely in this term. It's basically a pole at infinity plus, which is constant. These are the elementary matrices, and this is the x-independent piece. And it turns out, but with the same exact same Lie Poisson structure, the deformation equations, which are essentially the vanishing of the curvature of this connection, I'm not writing it down in detail, are equivalent again to an overdetermined but compatible set of Hamiltonian equations, in which again there's an explicit Hamiltonian part plus a sort of trivial part, which in this case is moving the eigenvalues at infinity. That also can be seen explicitly. And the types of, well, the Hamiltonians for the Fuchsian type deformations remain the same. The ones for the non-Fuchsian are not so obvious, but they can also be given a local form in terms of quadratic residue formula, trace residue formula, in which what figures is the original matrix multiplied by the resolvent of this leading term at infinity. And there's also a constant factor. And it turns out that the residue of this, taken at infinity in x, and at the particular eigenvalue Ta in y, is precisely the Hamiltonian that generates the deformations with respect to the Ta parameters. Now that was known quite a number of years ago, but for... I should say that just as the... Am I running out of time? How much time do I have? Oh, then I'm nowhere near the end. All right. Then I'm going to have to do what I don't like to do, which is to flash things rather rapidly. All I can say, for those who know it, it's nothing new. Yeah. I only have two more transparencies, so I can show you them both simultaneously, except for references. That's all I have. So let me just say, there is a Poisson structure. It's a very standard one on the space of such rational matrices. It's called the rational R-matrix, classical R-matrix structure. These rather Byzantine-looking formulas summarize a lot of Poisson brackets between all of the matrix elements simultaneously, and they're not really very complicated. They really are a lot of bilinear relations. With respect to those Poisson brackets, the general isomonodromic deformation equations of Jimbo, Miwa, and Ueno can also be proved, and this is the new result, to have a Hamiltonian form, and I'm going to give you what they are. This is the last transparency, so if I have 2 minutes, I think I should be able to do it. I'll put it over here. I guess that's the more important one. So this theorem, these two theorems, summarize all of the results, the new results, which generalize those examples. First of all, I guess I didn't mention it. It was on a previous transparency. The T's can be thought of as functions on a phase space, which is the space of such covariant derivative operators. They, together with the poles, have the Hamiltonian interpretation, or the Poisson interpretation, of being the Casimirs. They're exactly what cut out the symplectic leaves of that Poisson structure. So it was defined in terms of asymptotic behavior, but in fact there are local formulas, and one can prove that the whole center of that Poisson algebra, if we express T in terms of the matrices as functions on the phase space, is generated by them. So here's an explicit residue formula. I didn't say what Y is, of course. I'm going to have to take 2 more minutes. Is that livable? Doesn't like it? Okay. I just have to refer to this. It's such a fundamental thing. There's an object called... I think I'm even missing a transparency, am I? There's an object called the spectral curve, since I can't find the it is? The spectral curve? No. Oh, very good. Oh. Yes, this object. This is the spectral curve. It's the characteristic polynomial of A of X. The coefficients of that polynomial define the so-called spectral invariance. And the statement is the following, that that gives us actually an n-fold branched covering. It's a Riemann surface, which is an n-fold branched covering of the Riemann sphere. So we can think of y and x as mirror-morphic functions on this, and we can evaluate residues. So there's a mirror-morphic differential, y dx, which has a principal part and an analytic part. And the terms in the principal part are exactly the Casimirs, exactly the deformation parameters. In the opposite direction, the first terms in the opposite direction, in the analytic direction of this differential, gave exactly what are the logarithmic derivatives of the tau function. And those will be the Hamiltonians that actually generate the system. So here we can interpret them as functions on the phase space, not just on the parameter space. The infinitesimal deformations are obtained by taking the functional differential of these Hamiltonians with respect to the matrices A and evaluating their principal parts. And once again, there's a Hamiltonian part and a trivial part, and once again the trivial part, in the same sense, is just of such a form as to guarantee for such Hamiltonians that the deformations are zero curvature equations. So this actually gives a complete Hamiltonian description of the most general, generic, rational isomonodromic deformation equation. Theorem 2 is just an extra luxury which tells us that if we interpret these H's not as functions in the parameter space, but on the phase space, functions of the matrices A, they have a local representation, which is a trace formula very similar to what occurred in the, or maybe I didn't refer to it, in the case of a single second order polar infinity. This comes explicitly from perturbation theory. One just develops the eigenvalues of the matrix in the neighborhood of one of the singular points in terms of its values. So that's all I have to say.